Good evening, listeners. Welcome to Damn Radio. If you'd like to call in, please do. Call 573-746-8020 or email live at damradio.com. This is Jack's Car Show. I'm broadcasting live from the Lake Ozark Real Estate State-of-the-Art Studio. This is Damn Radio. So, tonight the main focus of the show is going to be pretty much the downfall of Chrysler. And, you know, you focus mostly on the Daimler-Chrysler era because that was really where things went downhill. But first I want to get into some miscellaneous stuff. So, the big news story the past couple weeks is there's a new car company called Slate, and they're going to try and charge $27,000 for electric trucks that don't have any features. And Jeff Bezos is a big investor in this company, and they're saying they want to start deliveries at the end of next year, which seems pretty optimistic to me, but, you know, you buy stuff on Amazon because it arrives quickly. So if he says so, that's cool, whatever. The main thing with this truck is you can customize it to however you want it to be, and that applies to everything, I know, but, you know, stuff like battery, okay, standard, it has 150 miles of range, but if you spend more, you get 240. That's pretty normal with EVs in general, but they're saying that at launch, you'll be able to buy 100 accessories for the truck, 100 accessories, which, like, if you've ever been on the Corvette configurator, like, 100 accessories, those are rookie numbers. Although these accessories aren't just stupid, like, color-coded valve stem caps or PPF strips or fitted luggage or anything like that. Slate is going to offer factory lift kits and lowering kits and different bumpers front and back and roofs and graphics, and you can make your truck exactly how you want it is the idea. In fact, they're saying that standard, it has wind-up windows and no stereo. So you can do whatever you want with this thing in theory. And when I say roofs, I mean roofs are an accessory. Standard, it's a pickup. But you can buy roofs and rear seats to make the thing into an SUV. And depending on which roof you get, you can make it look like any SUV you want, anything from P38 Range Rover to a new Land Rover Discovery. Yeah, they look like Land Rovers pretty much, but except for the pickup ones. The pickup ones just look like pickup versions of the new Land Rover Defender. But I'm interested to see how this thing sells, because keep in mind, it starts at $27,500 before options, and okay, the EV tax credit probably applies to that. So say you could, under the right conditions, get it down to $20,000. Even then, if I'm paying $20,000, I want a stereo. And for years, okay, there's been a small but vocal segment of the car community, and they say that they want a simple, bare-bones vehicle and that manufacturers don't need to include all the luxuries and stuff that they do. However, people who say that usually fall into one of two categories, really. People who own 911 GT3s, and they're not buying $30,000 electric pickup trucks. And the other category is people who complain on social media and own rusted-out base model pickups. Those guys aren't buying a new car, let alone an electric one. So neither of those categories of people who say they want a bare-bones vehicle are going to want this vehicle. Or, I mean, EVs in general, but, I mean, we'll see how this goes. It really just reminds me of the last time a company tried this idea in the United States, because remember the Nissan Pulsar from, like, the late 80s? Nobody does, because it didn't sell that well, but, you know, in the United States, it was just a sporty little coupe, you know, and the idea was that the back part of the car, the rear clamshell, and also the roof, it was removable, and you could change it out for other styles. I say other styles. There were two styles. You could have just a notch back with a regular trunk lid and a regular back glass, or you'd have this big canopy thing to make like a hatchback wagon sort of thing. And it was really cool. And you could remove all of it to have a big open convertible. It was a cool idea. It was a nice idea. But nobody in the United States was even slightly interested, so it flopped. So we'll see if Slate becomes anything outside of, I guess, like fleet vehicles. You know, that's kind of what they're saying that it might be used for is, you know, because you can customize it to however you want. So in theory, if you own a construction company or even just like a government fleet, like it kind of makes sense for that. But would ordinary people buy it? I don't know. I guess we'll see. Moving on, I want to talk about the Volkswagen ID Buzz. That's the new microbus looking electric minivan thing. They're charging far too much money for. But apparently they're recalling all the ID Buzzes because they're saying the third row seat is too wide, which is preposterous, actually. And it's not a safety problem in real life, but according to the NHTSA, it is. Because the NHTSA is, you know, throwing a fit, and they're making VW recall all these because they're saying that the third row bench is only designed for two people. You know, there are only two seat belts, but they're saying that Volkswagen made the seat too wide. So some people might try and squeeze three people in. So in other words, if you own one of these, the NHTSA wants you to take your vehicle into a dealer so that they can, free of charge, make your back seats tighter and less comfortable. Wonderful. The thing about it, though, I predict most owners are going to do it, especially ID Buzz owners, because they'll see a recall and they'll think, oh, no, scary recall. It's a safety problem. I need to fix it. They really shouldn't. If I own one of those, the dealer would have to pry it away from my cold, dead hands. I'd rather have more room. Although, granted, I'm generally pretty lackadaisical when it comes to recalls anyway. You know, when I see a recall that says, we need to replace your clutch because it could explode and throw shrapnel or catch fire at any moment, my reaction is pretty much just, you know, cool. Drive the thing for 20 years, put a ton of miles on it, and then when the clutch eventually wears out, free replacement. It's called being fiscally responsible. It's the trillionaire grind set. Only a few will understand. But seriously, this is not a safety issue. If you own an ID Buzz, just ignore this recall. It's the stupidest thing ever. But it sucks for VW, because I doubt they're making any money on this car to start with. It's basically just an electric minivan, but it starts at like $60,000, which, you know, that's on them, but still. I don't know how many people are buying it. But I'll tell you one thing. It's probably the only cool minivan, possibly ever. Because the minivan segment is dead. And I talked about this last show I did 2 weeks ago. The minivan's dead, not because it was a bad concept. It's just that nothing is less cool than a minivan, but this one is cool. It comes in funky two-tone color schemes, and it kind of looks like an old VW microbus. It's really cool. But it'll only be bought by baby boomers who kind of remember the old VW buses. No other demographic is going to be spending $60,000 or $70,000 on this thing. But anyway, I want to move on to motorcycles very briefly. BMW released the R1300 RT, and I always talk about BMW, it seems like, past few shows anyway. BMW finally released the R1300 RT and the RS. You know, when I say BMW motorcycle, most people think of the GS, all right? The big off-road adventure touring bike. And the 1300 GS has been out for a couple of years now. I guess it replaced the, obviously it replaced the 1250. But the thing about it is, the old 1250 RT, which is the big comfortable touring bike, like regular street touring bike, and the 1250 RS, which is the kind of lighter, swoopy, I guess, sport bike version of the GS. Well, they stayed in production alongside the new 1300 GS. So there's that, but they're finally replacing them with the new 1300 models, and they look fine. You know, it's really not that interesting of a thing. I always kind of like the look of the 1250 RS, and I kind of like the 1300 RS. And the new RT looks fine. I like the look of the old one, but the new one looks like whatever. It's fine. It looks exactly how you'd expect it to. But the 1250 RT guys are obviously going to hate on it because it's new and it's almost certainly better in every way. But that's just because what, you know, motorcycle owner communities do. They hate on new things. And you know, if you bought a $30,000 bike and they just replaced it with a better one, you wouldn't be thrilled about it. But it's like they throw a fit. It's almost like they have to justify owning an older bike. But BMW guys in general are hating on the 1300 RT, and naturally they're completely ignoring the fact that like the 1150 RT existed and the early 1200 RTs. Like, those were ugly ass bikes. The new one's fine. It's like whatever. It's new. People don't like new, unfamiliar things. The reason I bring this up is not the BMW guys' response. The group that I least expected to was hating on this thing too. I'm in a Honda NT 1100 Facebook group. And let me preface this by saying, nobody's really talked about the NT 1100. I think it's a really cool bike. I admire it immensely because it's basically an Africa Twin, you know, the big adventure bike that Honda makes. And it's the same engine, same frame, but it's more aerodynamic. It's got a more comfortable, wider seat, better wind protection. It's a touring-focused version of that. You know, it's not off-road in any way. It's a sport touring bike. And I tend to think it's probably the best value touring bike on the market. It gets good mileage. It's fairly quick. It's got the dual clutch transmission. It's supposed to be very comfortable. It's got electronic suspension and CarPlay and Android Auto and cruise control. And they start under $12,000. In my mind, the NT 1100, that's the return of the Silverwing from the 80s. You know, it's not quite a Goldwing. It's not quite as fast, not quite as comfortable. You lose some of the tech, but if touring's all you want to do and you're not made of money, I mean, I think the NT 1100 is probably excellent. You know, that's how the old Silverwing was, and the NT 1100 just seems like the modern equivalent. I think it's a great bike. And if I had $12,000 to spend on a bike and only $12,000 to spend on a bike, and I could only buy new, in that specific scenario, that's exactly what I'd get. On the other hand, it's absolutely hideous. Like, it's horrible. I've been meaning to talk about how ugly it is on here, but, like, hey, the NT1100 never really did anything to me, so I never had a reason to. But I recently saw a post in an NT1100 Facebook group, and everybody was talking about how ugly the new BMW RT is. Like, guys, you realize you bought NT1100s, right? Like, it looks like a scooter, but just taller and more bulbous. It's heinous. The NT1100 is perhaps the single ugliest bike currently on sale. The owners have no room to talk about styling. But there they are down in the comments talking about how ugly the new BMW RT is. I even saw a few guys say the NT1100 was way better looking than the RT. And obviously they're just coping, or they're insecure or something about how ugly their bikes are. But, you know, so they just have to jump into action like, hey, look how ugly that new bike is. Everybody look at it. The NT1100 guys, like, if they say a bike is ugly, that's pretty much confirmation that I should like the way that bike looks. So for that reason, my new least favorite motorcycle community, at least for this week, are NT1100 owners. But anyway, moving on to the main focus of the show, the Daimler Chrysler era. So a couple weeks ago, I talked about Chrysler and how they'd come out with a minivan. And as a company, they were really doing super well through the 80s and 90s. And now I want to talk about their downfall. And most of this is going to focus on the Daimler Chrysler years and just all the garbage they made during that time. Because really, Daimler Chrysler, that was where the train left the track for Chrysler. It seems like they were doing really great up until they got involved with Mercedes. Because almost every decision they made after that point was a mistake. And you know, on Mercedes' end, it seems like Mercedes just acquired them and ruined Chrysler and drained the resources and then just got rid of them. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about some specific cars that really ruined their image. But before that, let's start with the merger itself. Usually people kind of gloss over this, like Mercedes was doing good, Chrysler was doing good. They figured they could do good together, you know. There's more to it than that. I want to talk about where each company was coming from with this thing. So in the early 1990s, Chrysler was doing really, really well. Lee Iacocca had turned the company completely around. The K car had saved the company. In the late 80s, they acquired AMC, and that held the Jeep brand. They had the Neon, which was an excellent small car, made them a ton of money. Chrysler even had enough money to just throw at fun stuff, like the Dodge Viper and the Plymouth Prowler, and they even owned Lamborghini. Things were going really well at Chrysler. But Lee Iacocca stepped down as CEO in 1992, and that was the end of an era. And he passed the torch on to a guy named Bob Eaton, which was probably a mistake. It's not that Eaton was a bad businessman, but it seemed like he kind of just wanted to be as popular and famous as Lee Iacocca. He wanted to take Chrysler to the next level. He was really just focused on growing the company. And what's the easiest way to grow a company? You merge with another company. Now, on the Mercedes side, on the other hand, for most of the 1990s, Mercedes wasn't really doing great. That's not to say they were doing badly. They weren't. They were fine. But they weren't exactly killing it like maybe they should be. You got to keep in mind, Lexus came out in 89, and so Mercedes had just been playing catch-up, and they weren't doing it super well. To be clear, late 80s to the early 90s, that was when Mercedes was at their absolute peak. That was at a time when, yeah, Mercedes were flashy and expensive and technologically advanced, but more than that, they were the highest quality, best put together vehicles money could buy. Prior to the 1990s, most Mercedes buyers, I say most, across the board, not necessarily here in the States, but most Mercedes buyers were like Toyota Land Cruiser buyers. Like, you pay a lot of money for a very nice, very reliable, well-engineered vehicle, and then you just drive it for the next 20 years and put tons of miles on it and then replace it when something big fails, you know? It wasn't as true for stuff like the SL or the S-Class, but lower trim stuff, especially the diesels, absolutely. That was the Mercedes buyer. Mercedes were simply built to a high standard, but so was Lexus. I remember reading that in the 1990s, Road and Track did a survey, and they found that 96% of Lexus owners ranked their service experience as good or excellent. And that shattered the previous record held by Mercedes with 77%. I did a show about this a few months ago, but the LS400 changed the luxury car game. It was quieter and smoother than an S-Class, and it was lighter and faster, and the interior was nicer, and it was more modern. And on top of everything, the Lexus was way, way cheaper. That was really the nail in the coffin. You could maybe argue that Mercedes had more brand recognition and the craftsmanship was better, whatever you'd mean by that. The most important fact is that Lexus LS was usually about 2/3 of the price of the equivalent S-Class, in addition to being a more advanced car. And so Mercedes just sprung into action trying to just figure out how to compete. People tout the W140 generation S-Class as being the peak of the S-Class line, the last great one. the best engineered one, the one they spent 10 years and $1 billion to develop, and several executives lost their job in the process. I really don't hold the W140 in all that high regard, because yes, all that's true, but really the W140 signaled the end of Mercedes' reputation for reliability, at least to me, because it had issues. Famously, some Mercedes, 92 to 96 were the years, including the S-Class. They had everybody calls it a biodegradable wiring harness, but they just made the wiring harness out of garbage. And like 10 years after the car's new, you might have to just completely replace all the engine electrics. It was not good. And you know, by the W140 generation, the diesel model, usually was like unbelievably durable and reliable. Old diesel Mercedes were just indestructible. Well, they came out with a new and improved diesel one, the 350 SD. And that car and that engine kind of earned the nickname Rod Bender. It wasn't great. And even just down to little stupid stuff. Like, you know, before parking sensors, the S-Class had these little metal rods that pop out of the corners of the trunk lid so you can see in your rearview mirror where the corners of the car were. That was the idea. And it was, you know, it was a good idea, but you can't find one of those cars today with a pair of those that work. I mean, they don't exist. The fact is, 5 years prior to Lexus, Mercedes was at the top of every single reliability survey without fail. 5 years after Lexus, Mercedes was near the middle of the pack and dropping, pretty much. People say when they redesigned the S-Class in the late 90s, when they went from the W140 to the W220, the quality went downhill. My contention is it was already pretty downhill. But anyway, people say that the W220 wasn't as nice because Mercedes didn't spend as much money and time on development. And that's part of it. That's kind of part of it. They say that with the W140 S-Class, the one that came out in 92, Mercedes spent 10 years and $1 billion to develop it. You compare that to the W220, the 2001, the one everybody says is crap. Well, development costs weren't actually that far off. It also cost about $1 billion to develop, although you could argue that's 80s versus 90s dollars, the currency devalues, inflation, whatever. You know, it wasn't exactly the same amount of money, but okay, it was still very expensive. You could argue that Mercedes only spent 7 years developing the 220 S-Class compared to 10 with the 140. In my mind, it wasn't so much the money and effort that Mercedes put into the 220 that made the difference. It was what that money and effort went toward, namely figuring out how to make things cheaper. Because Mercedes used to spend money on... I remember that I read that they held a focus group to decide what was the perfect weight and springiness and travel of interior switches. That was where they put their money before. And now they're spending that money on basically just trying to figure out the perfect balance of nice-ish to the touch, but just cheap interior plastics. Before, they wouldn't have thought about using anything other than the very best thing that they could put in there. That was the change, really. I see people say that the Daimler-Chrysler partnership caused declines in quality on the Mercedes side, but keep in mind, the 220 only came out in 99, like for other markets. It was 2000 here, but that car came out in 99, and actually, you know, 98 for the 99 model year. Well, you know, the merger happened in 98, and it took 7 years to develop that car. So before Daimler-Chrysler was even a thing, Mercedes was planning on cheaping out. That was kind of the headspace that Mercedes was in when they decided to partner up with Chrysler. And so when people say that the Daimler-Chrysler merger ruined Mercedes' build quality, the quality would have gone downhill whether Chrysler was there or not. Because Mercedes had moved away from trying to build the best cars in the world to simply trying to build cars with, if nothing else, higher profit margins. And so you pair that with Chrysler, who made excellent cars by, you know, at a price. But Chrysler's run by a guy who wants nothing more than to expand as quickly as possible. That was the recipe for the Daimler-Chrysler merger. And to be clear, the idea behind the Daimler-Chrysler merger wasn't that stupid. Because in very simple terms, Mercedes made great luxury cars and Chrysler made great regular cars. You know, okay, great partnership. And in theory, Chrysler had a far more comprehensive dealer network in the United States and all that. And they figured they could make it work. Like, Mercedes puts in time and resources to develop a really nice car, you know, and then you just take advantage of economies of scale when you just apply those designs and those components to cheaper cars that you're going to sell millions of. You know, that was exactly the way Volkswagen and Audi was doing it at the time under Ferdinand Piëch. And VW was making more money than they knew what to do with at the time. And so early on, this wasn't a bad idea. And the Daimler-Chrysler merger actually started out strong. I mean, as a whole corporation, Daimler-Chrysler reported a 12% increase in revenue and a 38% increase in operating profits in their first year joined together. And the two sides tried to get along and understand each other. Like for example, the Americans took classes in German dining etiquette, stuff like that. But ultimately, none of that really worked. Because there was a lot more opposition between the two sides than there should have been. I mean, you know, they were two different companies from two different sides of the world. And also, you can just imagine that the dynamic here, you know. The way Mercedes feels is the Germans, they handcraft exquisite German-engineered Mercedes-Benz automobiles, and they're put in charge of babysitting the simple, fat, lazy Americans who haphazardly sling together disgusting, poorly engineered garbage. Meanwhile, the way Chrysler sees things is that the blue-collar working-class heroes working 9-to-5, slaving away on the Chrysler assembly line, putting together reasonably priced, well-made cars for the American everyman. Well, they feel like those aristocratic, snobby, pretentious Nazis think they're better than us, and they're trying to tell us what to do. That was always going to be the nature of that relationship. Both sides just kind of resent each other. That was just the way it was. And moving on to the cars themselves, I mean, the actual level of influence the Germans had over the cars that Chrysler made is kind of up for debate. You know, some German executives were installed over at Chrysler, but whether Chrysler would have come out with, for example, the 2007 Dodge Avenger on their own, I mean, who knows? I kind of doubt it because, again, prior to Mercedes ownership, and I do mean ownership, which I'll get to, Chrysler was absolutely killing it. Immediately after the partnership, they started coming out with stuff like the Jeep Liberty. And truthfully, this could have been a merger made in heaven, like they said early on. Even if each company simply continued on their own course, doing exactly what they wanted to without any corporate bureaucracy. But naturally, Chrysler was under new management, and so some new, exciting, revolutionary, often very stupid changes were made. First of all, the Eagle brand went away, which, you know, yeah, okay. That was coming. Eagle was pretty much to Chrysler what Geo was to General Motors. Like Eagle only existed to hold up their ends of contracts that AMC had made with Renault and a bunch of franchise dealers. And so, in 1998, Eagle's gone, that's fine. And they also started to phase out the Plymouth brand, which, again, it's not stupid. It would have happened eventually. In the late 90s, Plymouth was just, they were discount Dodge. And they didn't have any unique products, except, I guess, for the Prowler, which they sold none of. So, you know, okay, Plymouth can go. But then attention turned to developing some new models. Some good, some absolutely terrible. I guess the first place to start with would be to focus on how their new management set about pretty much just destroying some of Chrysler's most popular models. I'll start with some terrible redesigns after the break. I'll be right back. You're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio. When I really need you, you were gone. All right, so I want to start with some bad redesigns that Daimler Chrysler new management had made to some good old Chrysler cars. First one, most obvious one probably, 2002. Jeep discontinued the XJ Jeep Cherokee. I guess 2001 was the last year of it, but 2002, they came out with the Liberty. Everything that made the Cherokee successful went away. Chrysler claimed when they came out with the Liberty that what they were going after is they didn't want it to be somebody's second choice, meaning in Chrysler's mind, the consumer is going to look at the Grand Cherokee, and then they'll see the regular Cherokee, and then notice, well, it isn't quite as grand as the Grand Cherokee. So if somebody buys it, they're going to be settling for the regular Cherokee. I mean, evidently 3 million people settled for the regular Cherokee, but okay. So that explains why when they came out with the replacement, they changed the name to Liberty. They wanted it to be its own thing. Although it was still called the Cherokee in pretty much every other market, but in reality, Chrysler was completely wrong. People bought the Cherokee because they liked the Cherokee. That's why it was on sale for 18 model years. Again, 3 million sales, and it was still doing strong. I mean, it was still doing good sales numbers. If there was any settling going on, actually, it was the people who bought the Liberty. Because I think about this a lot. Can you imagine being one of the people who traded in a Cherokee for a Liberty? That's brutal. That's like, you'd be suicidal. It's horrible. But in any case, actually, the Liberty was, believe it or not, supposed to be more off-road focused than the Cherokee. Unfortunately, it wasn't. It lost a solid front axle. It got way heavier and it was way worse to drive. I mean, it was worse to drive on the streets, too. I mean, it handled worse, and it lost one of the things that made the XJ so great. That was the 4-liter straight six. And they replaced it with a new 3.7-liter V6, and on paper, it made slightly more power, 20 extra horsepower, 210 versus 190, but that didn't change the fact that the thing weighed 4,100 pounds. The Cherokee weighed like 3,400 when it was like at its heaviest. So the Liberty, despite being a newer, in theory, more advanced car, was actually way slower and handled way worse. And speaking of engines, one of the things that made the Cherokee so great is it was just legendarily, indestructibly reliable. Over the years, people would eventually discover the Liberty had just about every issue that a car could have. I mean, they were bad. And also, the main thing, probably, for consumers, the Liberty just looked way worse. The XJ was always a good-looking truck. It was an old-school, boxy-looking SUV. It was. I talked about this during the minivan show. The XJ Cherokee was the one that popularized family SUVs as a concept. That was the big one. Well, styling-wise, the Liberty was just an insult. And usually when an automaker redesigns a car, there's outrage. You know, I talked about this just a second ago with the BMW motorcycles. People don't like the new one. That's true across the board. It's always the case. They prefer the old one, rah, rah, rah. But over time, people kind of grow to like the new one such that in 7 years when they redesign it, they like the you know, they like that design and they don't want the new one, the new one. And it's just the way it goes. On the other hand, the Liberty came out and people hated it and they were exactly right. I can't think of another car where a manufacturer has dropped the ball so hard on a redesign. But they came close and they followed up the Liberty in 2005. They completely ruined the Grand Cherokee, too. Because, you know, the same thing they did with the Cherokee and the Liberty, they did with the WJ and the WK Grand Cherokee. Because I'll take you through the Grand Cherokees here. First generation, the ZJ, came out in 93. It was still very trucky. It was an excellent vehicle. As a concept, it's just a Cherokee, but more. Well, it wasn't the same car as a Cherokee, but it was the same idea. But, you know, this one's just bigger, and you get it with a V8 and a nice leather interior. It's great. And so 1999, Jeep releases the WJ. Great. Improved on the ZJ. Top trim versions are faster. And the WJ is, it's kind of softer and more comfortable and nicer to drive. Like, the ZJ is cooler. Objectively, the WJ is a better truck. Then 2005, the WK. Now, I understand you can't just make trucky, rough, rugged stuff forever. But, like, the WK, I just used this word with the Liberty, but your WK was also an insult. Because for one thing, it lost a solid front axle, which I don't care, but that was the big reason the Jeep purists hated it. It was just, the new Grand Cherokee was ugly, and the interior was just made of absolute crap, and they had electrical issues like crazy. But it was what Chrysler's new management decided buyers wanted. And to be clear, buyers usually did. I mean, the Grand Cherokee has always been popular. That's never changed. But, you know, the WK was just crap. It was objectively a bad vehicle. And so a year later, Jeep decided, hey, you know, the Grand Cherokee was originally the bigger version of the Cherokee. Let's make a bigger version of the Grand Cherokee. And so they came out with the XK. That's the Commander. It was based on the it was based on the Grand Cherokee, but it had third row seats. That was the main appeal. But despite that, it was only 2 inches longer than the Grand Cherokee, which, okay, you know, and it's 5 inches taller. So for all intents and purposes, it's a Grand Cherokee-sized car, but it has another row of seats. And so it's kind of cramped. And then with the third row in place, you don't really have any cargo space. And that was disappointing because it somehow the car just felt so much bigger than the Cherokee. And it got horrible fuel economy, and it wasn't that much more practical than a Grand Cherokee. And again, it's basically a Grand Cherokee underneath. And so everything that was bad about that generation Grand Cherokee was also bad about the Commander, except for the styling. I like the styling of the Commander. I think it was a good-looking truck. But still, it wasn't that great a truck. It didn't sell all that well. In its best year, it sold about half as many. Like, best year, first year, it sold about half as many as Chevrolet sold the Tahoe. And it got worse after that. And the Commander was widely agreed to not be a very good vehicle. In fact, after the Commander was canceled and Chrysler was absorbed into Fiat, which is kind of skipping ahead, the CEO of Fiat Chrysler went on record as saying that the Commander was unfit for human consumption. And then he went on to say, we sold some, but I don't know why people bought them. Which, it's, like, that truck existed under his leadership for a couple of years. It's not exactly nice. And I don't think it's completely fair, given that this is the guy who gave us the Fiat 500L, but in any case, the Commander could have been done better, as was the case with a lot of Daimler Chrysler era cars. But anyway, moving on to another horrible redesign slash replacement. Back in 1994, Chrysler released the Neon, and it was an excellent car. It was a compact car. It was supposed to compete with stuff like the Civic and the Corolla, and it did well. Because, you see, usually when American companies try and compete directly with the Japanese competition with that kind of stuff, American cars can compete approximately on size and price and maybe style. That's about it. But the Japanese are usually far superior in terms of build quality, reliability, usually style, performance, and like just fun, or at least charm. But with the Neon, you could argue maybe build quality, reliability, although it was very good on that car. The fact is the Neon beat the Japanese stuff in all of those categories. Because keep in mind, you know, 1994, you could still get a Civic with 70 horsepower. If you wanted to. Even the top of the line Civic Si had 125. But you could get the Neon with a choice of two engines. The base model had 132 horsepower, which obviously that's more than any Civic, but it's also more than the Miata. Like, it's decent power for this little car. And then there was a twin cam 150 horsepower version. So that was a quick little car. And the Neon, the handling was excellent because it didn't weigh much. It weighed like 2,300 pounds. And it got great mileage. And even better than that, the cheapest Civic that year was about $12,000, you know, high 11s. The Neon started in the 9s. And so the Neon was a great car and a great value, and it was a big hit. And they sold about 1.5 million first-gen Neons across 6 model years. But the main thing that attracted people to it was the styling. It was cute. And Chrysler really played that up in their advertising. It's a happy, cute, friendly little car. The ads were stuff like this here.
Its visibility and cab-forward roominess will brighten your outlook. Its dual airbags and steel door beams will help you feel safe and protected. And its fuel-injected multi-valve engine will put a smile on your face. Dodge Neon. It brings a whole new meaning to the phrase, have a nice day. Say hello to Dodge Neon. Around 9.3 for starters and under 12.4 nicely equipped.
See, it's just a nice, happy little advertisement, just like the car. Here's another one. I suppose I should explain what's going on here. It's like all the nature is kind of just moving into the cabin of the car. All the landscape.
The enormously enjoyable 2-liter, 16-valve, cab-forward Dodge Neon sedan. Boy, is it big inside. Say hello to Dodge Neon at your friendly Dodge dealer.
The thing about it is that the most famous Neon ad of all of them was just a print of the front of the car, and it had the caption, "Hi." Like capital H, lowercase I, period. Hi. The car slogan was a greeting. That was how they pitched it. It was just a friendly phrase on a friendly little car. And it did really well. And the second gen Neon came out, it was fine. But, you know, on that platform, Chrysler had the PT Cruiser. That was really the sales leader there. But, and by the way, that was another Chrysler win, you know, no thanks to Daimler. But eventually Chrysler decided to replace the Neon. Keep in mind, they originally sold the Neon based on it being cute. And they replaced it with the Caliber, and they wanted people to think that it was not cute. You know, when you say bad morning to the teacher, like, oh God, you're so tough, just like the Caliber, it's so menacing. Truthfully, the Caliber was just about the least intimidating car ever devised, but they wanted people to think it was badass. And, I mean, the Caliber is just a regular little hatchback. They wanted it to be taller and more SUV-like, but oh, it's just so threatening. And they came out with the Caliber, and this is how they pitched it. I'll play you this ad, and it's a focus group of various cutesy little animated creatures. There's a unicorn. There's I guess it's like a cartoon hedgehog, and there's a big green furry guy, and whatever. They're all looking at the new Caliber. Here it is.
So, what do you think?
Don't take this wrong, but it doesn't make me feel all warm and fuzzy inside.
Right. Yeah, I find it dark and disturbing.
I mean, it's neither cuddly nor waddly.
Okay. Binky, any thoughts?
It scares the out of me.
Perfect.
That's just the reaction we were looking for.
The all-new Dodge Caliber. It's anything but cute.
It's not a good ad, but the idea that they're trying to convince buyers that the Caliber is, like, tough and intimidating, it's hilarious to me. Which I mean, to be fair, when I see a Caliber now, I do kind of think, oh no, hide the catalytic converters. But that's got nothing to do with the car's appearance. But naturally, the advertising didn't really work. The Caliber was on sale for the same number of years as the first-gen Neon, but they only sold about a quarter as many. Mostly because the Caliber was just garbage. It was a hatchback that tried to pretend to be off-road focused and intimidating. And so in that way, it was kind of ahead of its time. You know, that's true of pretty much everything now, but the Caliber was just crap. I mean, it was a car, it came out in 2007, and air conditioning was an option. And it drove terribly, and it was built like crap. But that didn't stop Chrysler from offering not one, but two Jeep versions. The Compass, which is pretty universally disliked for being too soft, and people say it's disrespectful to the Jeep name. And the Patriot, which is equally terrible, but it's like it's more boxy, so people kind of forget about that one. And this reminds me, around this time, Jeep redesigned the Liberty, and they actually made it kind of better. It's not good, but anything's better than the original Liberty. But this time it was based on the Dodge Nitro. And I guess now I'm moving away from bad redesigns and just into Chrysler pretty much making bad cars for the sake of making bad cars, it seems. When I think of bad cars, the Dodge Nitro is usually one of the ones that comes to mind, because the Dodge Nitro really just encapsulates everything wrong with the cars Chrysler made during that time. And this is largely true of everything I just mentioned and more, but the Nitro wasn't especially terrible in any one way, but it was pretty bad in just about every way. You know, it wasn't like a 2000s Audi is bad where it's just a total mechanical basket case. Like the Nitro, it usually scored below average in the reliability surveys, but that's about it. And it wasn't bad like it was horrible to drive. It was slow and it handled like garbage, which you kind of expect of a vehicle that size. It wasn't that terrible. Wasn't, you know, worth writing home about how bad it was to drive. And it wasn't ugly on the level of, say, a Fiat Multipla. And in fact, I could even see how when it came out, people might have liked the way the Nitro looked. But the styling can really just best be described as boxy for the sake of being boxy and just forgettable. And the Nitro was poorly made, but again, it's not the worst in the world. The Nitro was entirely forgettable. And that's really the area where it excels. Because really, the Nitro, as well as the Liberty and the Patriot and the Compass and the Caliber and the Avenger and the Sebring and the 200 and all sorts of other Daimler Chrysler era garbage, they were usually not horrible in any one way. They were all just generally bad in most ways. Except there was nothing unique or charming or exceptional or beneficial in any way to the overall advancement of the automobile that you could say was true of any of these cars. And that wasn't true of a lot of Chrysler's 90s stuff. I mean, the minivan was a game changer. The second gen Ram was great, as was the Dakota and Durango, as was every Jeep. And even the big floaty stuff, like the Chrysler LHS. You know, it's a kind of car that Europeans would crap on because it's a big front-wheel drive luxury sedan made by Americans. You'd expect it to be crap, but it wasn't. It was an exceptionally good car. You know, and that was what Chrysler used to make. And you could argue that the Daimler Chrysler era crap that I just named was at least cheap. And that's not to say competitively priced, but the fact is, prior to this merger, Chrysler had made a business of selling cheap cars. That was what they did. But prior to Daimler getting involved, those cheap cars were usually good, or at the very least, charming. It almost seems like Daimler, on some level, just wanted Chrysler to know their place, so that they simply made sure that all the cars the Chrysler division made weren't allowed to be groundbreaking or exciting in any real way. Maybe so that Mercedes would appear exceptional. I have no idea. That's maybe my theory. Although, to be fair, during this time, Chrysler occasionally made some good stuff. Namely, the LX platform, the 300 and the Charger Challenger. I'll get to that after the break. You're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio. So some of the Daimler influence on Chrysler is just kind of weird to me. Because it just shows up in some weird places on certain Chrysler products. Like the thing that always stuck with me, you know how in luxury cars in the 2000s and in the 90s, specifically Mercedes is where I remember it, but you turn the key in the ignition and, you know, you only got to turn it once briefly. You know, you turn the key and then you let go and it'll keep cranking until the engine starts. You don't have to hold the key turn, you know. I remember seeing that in a JK Wrangler and I thought it was just bizarre that, you know, it's a Jeep Wrangler. It's a piece of farm equipment. It's a little utility vehicle with cloth seats and all that. And it has the, like, Mercedes-style ignition switch. And I thought it was a nice little touch. On the other hand, stuff like the Dodge Nitro existed. And so there was definitely some give and take with this partnership. But the Daimler Chrysler era had at least one big win, and that was the LX platform. So in 2005, Chrysler came out with the LX platform, and they released the 300. And that was really a big deal. Because people were all excited because America finally had an actually competitive luxury car, so everybody thought. Because we had the Lincoln Town Car and the Cadillac DTS, but that was all just old school American style crap. Chrysler made a big deal about how Chrysler engineers went over to Germany to study certain Mercedes models, most notably the E-Class and the S-Class, and how the 300 had Mercedes-inspired suspension and used a Mercedes 5G-tronic automatic transmission, which, honestly, by 2005, that transmission was kind of a dinosaur. They were really only putting that in AMG stuff because it was just kind of old and durable and could take a beating. You know, Mercedes, for the most part, had moved on to 7-speeds, but, you know, whatever. The 300 has a Mercedes gearbox, great. And the car had more Mercedes stuff than that, differentials, switch gear, etc. It was not a Mercedes. People like to throw around the notion that the LX platform is based on the E-Class. It wasn't really. It's like if somebody had described the E-Class platform over the phone, and quality-wise, it wasn't a Mercedes. You know, the 300 was not a Mercedes. The interior was absolute garbage, horrible plastics everywhere. The ride quality wasn't great. I've heard people say that it isn't that the ride in the Chrysler 300 is harsh. It's that it's too soft that it's harsh. Like, you hit a bump, but the suspension's so soft that it can't immediately react to said bump, and so it'll just jar the entire car, you know, before actually doing anything to cover up the bump with the suspension, that sort of thing. And despite having the suspension based on an E-Class, it handled pretty poorly, which, you know, it's a big luxury car. It's fine. But on the other hand, the 300 was very fast. The 300C model came with the 5.7-liter Hemi, and that was 340 horsepower. 340 was pretty solid in 2005. I mean, keep in mind, a year prior, the Corvette only had 350. The main thing with the 300 was price. And if you could put aside the plasticky interior and the mushy suspension and then the questionable handling, this was a nice, absolutely gorgeous, fast, spacious, full-size luxury car for $34,000 or $57,000 in today's money. That's for the V8 one. Like, you could get a base model with a V6, and that started at 23, which is $39,000 in today's money. But even if you wanted to go all out, you get the fully loaded 425-horsepower SRT8 version. That was only 39, which at the time, that was cheaper than any BMW 5 Series. But in a straight line, you know, the SRT8 could compete with an M5. The 300 was an absolute bargain. That was really the appeal. And again, it looked fantastic because even though I acknowledge that the 300 isn't really all that great of a car, it had that charm, like the Chrysler charm. I still want one. The early ones definitely looked the best, but the facelifted SRTs looked pretty good too. I know I'd be disappointed if I got one, but I still look for them occasionally because the 300, it just looks so, it looks like a cartoon mafia car. It's just such a cool looking thing. But anyway, 2005, that same year, Dodge released the Magnum, which is the station wagon based on that same LX platform. People forget this. The Magnum came out a year before the Charger did. I have no idea why, but I guess Daimler Chrysler thought a modern station wagon would be a big hit. Listen, I love station wagons. They're never a big hit. And I love the Dodge Magnum, especially the V8 ones, but, you know, a station wagon in 2005, that was not going to be a big success, and it wasn't. It lasted for 4 model years, you know, 05 to 08, and they only sold about 16,000. But on the other hand, 2006, one of the most important events in black history took place. Dodge released the Charger, and it was a big success, so much that they only really made little minor revisions to it until they took it out of production less than a year and a half ago at the time of saying this. Like, the end of 2023, this thing was on sale from 2006 to 2023. And it wasn't even for lack of sales. I mean, they always sold great. They sold about 1.8 million of them between those model years. It was just that Chrysler was just getting fined millions every year because they put these massive V8s in them and they were got horrible fuel economy. And so, you know, if your corporate average fuel economy isn't good, you have to pay fines. And so Chrysler just got sick of paying that. Is what happened there. So they said they're going to make it all EV now. I'll get to that. But based on that same LX platform, Dodge released the Challenger in 2008. And that also ended production in 2023. And they sold about 600,000 of those, which that's pretty solid for a car that's, well, arguably based on 2003 Mercedes stuff. And it remained almost entirely unchanged mechanically for 16 model years. Oh, the pedophile's calling. I guess he wanted me to wish him a happy birthday or something. Anyway. So, let me turn that down. So, there we go. Anyway, based on the same LX platform, the Challenger existed. And it's 600,000 units. I mean, two-door cars don't sell that well. But this one did, and so the big V8 muscle car stuff, that was a big hit for Chrysler. It always was, and it made them a lot of money. But the thing is, that's everything wrong with Chrysler, because if those were their bread and butter, and those cars were, that really just shows how horrible they are at building normal cars. If your big muscle cars are like where you make the money, that's not a great sign. And also, I can't talk about the Daimler-Chrysler merger without talking about the Chrysler Crossfire. That was probably the most famous collaboration between Mercedes and Chrysler. I've talked about the Crossfire on here before and how it wasn't a bad car. It just kind of got the short end of the stick. But the Crossfire came out for the 2004 model year, and it was based on the R170 generation Mercedes SLK. And that was going out of production in 2004. And it was going to be replaced by a faster, stiffer, better handling, newer model. And so already the Crossfire is at a disadvantage, which, okay, it's a cheaper car, but still. And the Crossfire was only available with the 3.2-liter V6 out of that SLK. And by the way, that was the higher trim engine in that SLK, so that's good, I guess. But the Crossfire across the board was supposed to be sportier than the SLK. For one, it was lighter, which not by much. It was about 150 pounds for the coupe, but the suspensions were the same. And honestly, if you're trying to make a sports car, the Mercedes SLK isn't really a great starting point. It's really always supposed to be more of a soft, comfortable cruiser. That's why people bought the Mercedes. You know, it was a stylish, higher-end alternative to, say, a BMW Z3. You know, people didn't want a Miata. They wanted the cool roadster look, but they wanted to show that they were better than some poor person in a Miata. And so, and the SLKs were expensive, but that's okay. You know, it's a Mercedes. The Crossfire was at least cheap compared to an SLK. Like, really only compared to the SLK, because during the same year, 2004, the Crossfire was about $14,000 or $15,000 cheaper than the SLK 320. So honestly, it was kind of a bargain because it wasn't like the Mercedes was better engineered or anything. There was the same car underneath, and it wasn't like the Mercedes had a nicer interior. The original SLK interior was crap, and you know, the new 2005 model interior wasn't much better. And even when it came to styling, you know, I think the SLK was a better looking car generally, but it had been out since 1996, and so it looked dated. So the Chrysler looked newer. The only way to think about the Chrysler really is that it was a bargain SLK, because it couldn't compete in price with the Nissan 350Z or Honda S2000 or Miata or RX-8, and it couldn't compete in terms of brand name with the BMW Z4 or Audi TT or even the SLK, but it did a somewhat decent job of kind of straddling that line. You know, it actually sold somewhat decently, 76,000 units. That's about It's about 30,000 more than Toyota sold of the Mark IV Supra. So this thing actually was a pretty decent success, considering what it was. I mean, they just kind of slapped it together using an old platform, but still. But the Crossfire was one of the only real collaborations between Daimler and Chrysler. And even that was just lazily putting a different body on an old car. One thing I always thought was weird was that Daimler Chrysler, both sides, they eventually offered their own version of their sports tourer ideas, which this is weird to me because it's not quite a minivan, not quite a wagon, not quite an SUV. But nobody else was doing that besides Daimler Chrysler. Although within the Daimler Chrysler, they had two cars that were completely different. They had nothing in common. Chrysler came out with the original Pacifica for the 2004 model year, and it was kind of cool for what it was. It looked modern for the time, and it was shaped like a big three-row crossover with a low roofline. You know, although it was based on the minivan platform. But the Pacifica sold reasonably well, you know, 400,000 units in 5 years. It wasn't that bad. It wasn't what they were hoping for, but it wasn't that bad. 2 years later, Mercedes came out with their own grand sports tourer based on the ML. It was the R-Class. It's pretty much the same idea as the Pacifica, but it was a Mercedes, and it was better. It didn't sell super great, but it kind of shows you how pointless this whole partnership was. Because both were trying to create this new segment, and they offered two completely separate cars that you could really only compare with each other. It wasn't necessary. And that reminds me, I've pretty much only focused on the Chrysler side of things and their cars and how they suffer from this partnership. I haven't talked much about the Mercedes side of things. Now, among Mercedes enthusiasts, the Daimler-Chrysler years are seen as the worst era of Mercedes in terms of quality. People kind of lump crappy Chrysler quality in with questionable 2000s Mercedes quality. To me, Mercedes did that to themselves, as evidenced by the W220 S-Class. Mercedes wanted to cut costs, and they did, and the car suffered. And people kind of blame that on Chrysler. To be clear, I think very highly of 2000s Mercedes. That's like my favorite era of Mercedes. That like 2003-ish generation where you had the 220 S-Class and the 215 CL and the 230 SL and the 211 E-Class, and they came out with the Maybach, and it was really the peak, in my opinion. But that's pretty much just down to the fact that those have always been the cheap used cars I've sat around fantasizing about owning. They were inarguably of a lower quality than Mercedes of the 80s and 90s. But, you know, definitely during the Daimler Chrysler, you know, years, the Mercedes quality declined, but it was mostly because of Mercedes, is my point. And as you'd expect, most of Chrysler's cars became absolute garbage, and so Chrysler starts to hemorrhage money, and that affects both companies' bottom lines. Overall, though, Mercedes didn't fare anything like as badly as Chrysler through all this, and that's pretty much because Chrysler was never really anything more than a subsidiary of Mercedes. Because for all their talk early on about a merger of equals and a match made in heaven and all that, over time it became clear who was actually in charge. Because, in fact, 2 years into the partnership, the CEO of Daimler Chrysler, it's a German name I'll try, Jürgen Schrimpf, or Jürgen Schrimpf with two P's. He did an interview where he basically came right out and said that the whole partnership thing was just a lie. He said that the whole merger of equals thing was just to win the support of the American public, but it was never really the case. Chrysler was just a subsidiary of Mercedes all along. So when I say that Chrysler cars were specifically set up to be mediocre, that's kind of what I mean. I mean, why make exceptional cars? Just make cheap cars. But I mean, really, what was the point of the merger as a whole? I mean, there was no real partnership to speak of. Chrysler made Chrysler cars, granted with a bunch of intervention and red tape from higher up. Mercedes made Mercedes cars, and there was very little overlap. I mean, there was a little part sharing here and there on a few suspension components and transmissions, but there was no shared dealer network, which they talked about that early on. I don't know why there would be. Like, it's Chrysler and Mercedes. I mean, you're operating at two completely opposite ends of the credit score range there. It's a weird partnership that never really had a reason to take place, but whatever. The partnership had taken its toll. And in less than a decade, Chrysler had gone from being probably the most promising, profitable, forward-thinking automaker to losing money hand over fist. And so, naturally, Mercedes pretty much just drained Chrysler's corporate bank account and they jumped ship. And at first, like, it looked like Mercedes was going to sell Chrysler to General Motors, but obviously that never materialized. Ultimately, in 2007, Mercedes ended up paying a private equity firm called Cerberus Capital $650 million to get rid of it. I'll say that again. Mercedes wanted out so badly, they paid a company $650 million to take over a controlling stake in a major automaker. That was how bad things were at Chrysler. And after that, after they got sold, I mean, Chrysler pretty much just floundered for another couple of years until, you know, 2008 happened and all the automakers were in trouble. In 2009, Chrysler went bankrupt and they were bailed out in part by the U.S. and Canadian governments, but also 20% stake was purchased by Fiat. And over time, Fiat bought more and more stake in Chrysler, and they eventually acquired it, and they acquired it and became Fiat Chrysler Automobiles, or FCA. Fiat overall didn't really do a whole lot with Chrysler, except where they haven't, I guess. They haven't really done a whole lot with Chrysler, you know, except for the Jeep brand. They came out with a new Grand Cherokee, which was 1,000 times better than the WK, and they redesigned the Compass, and they brought back the Cherokee name, which, honestly, they put it on an even more insulting vehicle than the Liberty, but you know, the Cherokee exists again, although not at the time of saying this. And they replaced the Patriot with the Renegade, and that's about it, really. But they did some stuff with Jeep. FCA kept making the Ram, like the same generation Ram, for quite a while. Although they did split the Ram brand off from Dodge during that time. Chrysler kept making minivans. I guess under Fiat, they came out with the Pacifica, and they kept making the 300, and they came out with the new 200. Dodge came out with a new Dart, and I guess there was a new Viper. But that was more or less it. Like, the Dodge lineup, apart from the Dart, remained pretty much unchanged since forever. And that became something of a joke among enthusiasts. I remember everyone saying that Dodge's entire lineup was at least a decade old, and it was just the same old Charger and Challenger and Durango and Journey. And the Journey was just a joke, really. Dodge made the Journey up until the 2020 model year, which is just pathetic. It was crap when it came out in 09, and it was even more crap when it finally went out of production. But it did sell well because it had seven seats and it was extremely cheap, but it wasn't a good vehicle. One thing that always stuck with me is that until the very end, the Journey offered a four-speed automatic. Again, this went off the market in 2020. I remember reading a Jalopnik article back in 2018, and I went back and found it when I prepared for this. I found the quote that I think is just hilarious. On Dodge's website at the time, they described the four-speed automatic transmission saying, "The four-speed automatic transmission automatically changes gears so you don't have to shift gears manually." It's cutting-edge stuff. That was a 2018 automobile. They made that car for two more years after that was written. Although I guess technically it's true. You know, and you couldn't really say that about some of the Journey's competitors. I mean, namely the Chevy Traverse. You know, the Traverse has a transmission. Sometimes it changes gear. Other times, you know. But by the way, do you remember like back a decade ago seeing Chrysler 300 and 200 ads with the slogan "imported from Detroit"? I do. I still think it's silly, but I had that recollection like right before I did this show. But my point is, apart from the Jeep line, Fiat didn't really do a whole lot with Chrysler's model range. In the case of Dodge, they just kept making the same old cars and fitting them with crazier and crazier engines. And again, the Charger and Challenger sold really well. There was nothing wrong with that, but still. But in 2021, Fiat Chrysler merged with PSA, which is Peugeot and like Opel and some others. And they formed Stellantis. It's all Stellantis now. And the cars are, you know, a lot of them are the same. And by the way, Dodge is still selling that same Durango that came out in 2011. But other than that, Dodge, there's that one, and they only sell two other cars, and they're both new. They make the Hornet, which is, to me, one of the worst value cars currently on sale. I'll tell you a story about the Hornet. I was in a Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram dealer not that long ago. I was getting some service work done, and I was talking to a salesman, and he was like, "Hey, you want to go ride around in that Hornet?" And I'm like, "Not really." And he's like, "It's actually pretty fast." And I'm like, "Yeah, okay." And I should clarify here. This guy was not trying to sell me on this vehicle. I was walking around, like, looking in the windows of Wranglers and Gladiators, trying to find one with a manual transmission, and I couldn't. But he walked up to me, and, you know, how that goes. I mean, he walks up, and he's like, "Hey, you know, can I..." I pretty much told him right off the bat that I was getting service work done. I wasn't going to buy anything. Like, basically, I'm just basically telling him, like, don't waste any time on me. Like, I don't mind talking, but just know I'm not going to buy anything. And he's like, "Yeah, okay, that's cool. Just pretend like you are going to buy something so I can kill some time. It's a slow day." And so when he told me the Hornet was fast, it wasn't like he was trying to get me to buy it. Like, the way he delivered it was more like just a fun fact. And naturally, I had always assumed the Hornet was garbage, and so I was skeptical. But, like, you know, I was just walking around killing time anyway. So if he wants to go for a ride, great. So we jump in it. We ride down to the gas station, and in this is a fully loaded Hornet. And honestly, it felt pretty quick. You know, the acceleration reminded me of like an automatic EcoBoost Mustang like you rent from an airport. 0-60 is about 5.5 seconds. It's not bad. It's pretty solid. And it was certainly way better than I was expecting from the Hornet, which was like, again, that replaced the Journey. And so I'm thinking, okay, these things are like 30 grand. The interior seems okay enough. It's Alfa Romeo underneath. It seems like a pretty solid deal, you know? But then I actually sit down and look it up. The Hornet starts at 30 grand, but that one with all the hybrid system and all that was $50,000. Like, it was a fine car. I kind of thought it was a little crappy, like all Stellantis products kind of are, but, you know, for 30 grand, I thought it was a fine car, not $50,000 fine. I'm actually astounded. So we'll see how many of those Hornet hybrids they sell. Not many, I predict. And they canceled the wonderful selling LX/LD/LC platform Charger and Challenger and 300. And they replaced it with a new Charger and Challenger. It's all electric. And truthfully, I like the new Charger a lot. It seems like a kind of unpopular opinion. I've only ever seen criticism of it. But granted, I've never driven one. I've heard it's not super great. Like, it's electric, so it's probably very quick. But I've heard it's expensive for what it is. But I know two things about it, about the new Charger. one, you can guarantee they're going to come out with just a stupid fast version of it. And two, the new Charger looks fantastic. It looks like a modern version of the 60s Charger. I think it's cool. I think it's really nice. Nice looking anyway. But they took a lot of heat for that move to electric, such that now they're going to... Chrysler came out about a month and a half ago. They said they're going to do a V8 version of the new Charger. Like, as in, they took so much crap that people bullied them into giving it a V8. So we'll see about that. But the actual Chrysler brand is, for all intents and purposes, dead. Like, the Chrysler brand. I talked about this last week, but Chrysler currently offers one model, which they claim is three models. There's different versions of the Pacifica. And I suspect when the Pacifica inevitably gets canceled in a couple of years, I think the Chrysler nameplate goes away with it. Dodge, we'll see what happens with the Challenger and Charger. I think they'll be cool, but I guess we'll see. Ram's going to keep making trucks. Jeep will probably be the main focus of Stellantis' attention, like usual. Buyers like Jeeps. But anyway, that's modern day. That's pretty much it. That was pretty much the story of Chrysler going from the top of the world to just completely falling off a cliff. So anyway, that's the show. So I'm going to go ahead and run through the schedule. I didn't do last time. It seems like I'm the only one doing this anymore, but so Tuesday, tomorrow. Actually, tonight, 9 to 10:30, International Flavor, 5 days a week. That's Sam's new time slot. He's not doing the 4 anymore. Tuesday, 2 to 4, Really Big Shoe, 9 to 10:30 is International Flavor. Wednesday, 9 a.m., The Damn Swag, 11 to 1, Gabby Hayes Show. Again, Really Big Shoe, 2 to 4, that's 5 days a week. 6 to 8, the Ike Skelton Radio Show on Wednesday, and then International Flavor again. Thursday, International Flavor, or Really Big Shoe, International Flavor. Friday, Nadine at 9 with Nadine at 9. And 6 to 8, Eye of the Beholder with Paulie. And yeah, Sam's not doing that. He's doing Sundays to Thursdays now. Sunday, International Flavor. And then Monday morning, 11 a.m., Shield Maidens of Missouri, Stacey Shore, Lisa Panette. Really Big Shoe, and then we're back here. So, anyway, this has been Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio. Thank you for listening.